It's a great pleasure to be talking to my former teacher from 1967, when I used to attend his seminars on marriage with Isaac Shapira and one or two others, Ronald Dorr, very distinguished Japanologist and sociologist. So, Ron, just a few quick questions, if I may,
mm-hmm.
loading books. You were born in 1925
mm-hmm.
In Bournemouth.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me just very briefly something about your parents or your family.
My father was born in a village outside Poole called Waterloo. From the age of 19, at the end of the First World War, he joined the railway, Southern Railway. And when I was born, was a cleaner, and during my childhood progressed to the elevated rank of fireman. And in fact, we moved to Brighton for 4 years, because that way he could be promoted from cleaner to fireman 2 years, probably 2 years earlier than if he'd stayed in Brighton, because the whole system worked purely on seniority. And then we went back to Poole, and he became a driver and ended with the distinction of taking the expresses from Bournemouth to London for the last 5 years of his career.
Wasn't there a famous
The Brighton Bell?
Yes, the Brighton Bell.
The Brighton Bell. There was the Brighton Bell, yes, yes.
Not your father. Not your father.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, wasn't there a Bournemouth Bell too? I'm
Bournemouth
not sure.
Bell.
Bournemouth.
Yes.
That's the one I was thinking. So how was it that you moved from a background where your father was working on the railways to going to School of Oriental and African Studies?
The typical grammar school route.
Mm-hmm.
I was one of the brightest of the...
What grammar school
was it? Poole Grammar School, in the elementary school. We were not terribly conscious of the grammar school until we came to the age of 10 or 11. And I don't remember terribly well, but I do remember one of the teachers coming home to tell my parents that it was terribly important that that I got good sleep before the exam. And then, of course, they were faced with the choice of finding the money for the clothes and the prospect that I wouldn't be earning from the age of 14, but, you know, have to have another. But they were terribly keen. And I do remember my mother was very solicitous about my getting a good education. And I do remember that when, alas, you know, I do somewhat regret the fact that I can't tell stories about how I used to get up at 5 a.m. and do a paper round and work on Saturdays. Well, because my mother was so protective, she said, no, he's got his homework to do and it takes him so long. My father really wanted me to do a paper round, but my mother protected me from the paper round. And so I was coddled through grammar school. And then at the age, when I was in the second year of the sixth form and due to take the higher school certificate in June, there came a circular from the Board of Education in January, February, which was 2 months after the war had started. The war with Japan had started. And the circular said that they were recruiting people for 4 exotic languages for military purposes. Turkish, Persian, Chinese and Japanese. And the English master, I remember, came in with this piece of paper and said, Dorr, you should apply for this. Anthony Eden read Persian at Oxford and, you know, look where he's got. And that was encouragement enough.
So
I applied.
Mm-hmm.
And we were interviewed by a formidable committee, which included...
It was at the School of Oriental and African Studies. was.
No, it was in what is now the Commonwealth Office, I think, somewhere. There was the librarian of the Foreign Office. I think it was where the Foreign Office library then was. A rear admiral and a general and whatever. And I remember the rear admiral. I mean, the highlight of the interview, the only thing that has remained with me, and now remains because I've repeated the story several times, not because I directly remember it, I've no doubt, is the rear admiral who said, come from Poole, I see. Do any sailing? But my uncle rents out rowing boats. And yes, I got in. Yes, there was a professor of linguistics at the School of Oriental Studies, whose name I now cannot remember. And we sat in a little cubbyhole with her for 5 minutes, saying things like "schlinge schlong sixpence" and "ping ping ping ping." And then we were given a choice of the languages. And I chose Turkish as my first choice because we'd done the Eastern question at school and, you know, it was interesting. I knew where Turkey was. But all. And my second choice was Chinese. And when I arrived, I was told, you're on the Japanese course.
The others were oversubscribed, presumably, and no one wanted to do Japanese.
That seemed to be the case. I mean, there were 30 of us learning Japanese. Peter Parker said that he actually chose Japanese, but my impression is that the majority were bullshy and irate about it, and we were pacified, you know, with being told that this was quite the most difficult and the most honourable thing to have been chosen for, and so on.
So you spent how long learning Japanese?
Well, at that point, the School of Oriental Studies, when negotiating with the army with the course, said, yes, we'll take them, but maximum teaching, 2 hours a day. And, of course, you know, university terms are 3 10-week terms a year, and on that basis we'll certainly take them on. So we had long summer holidays, but otherwise had almost nothing to do. We were billeted with Dulwich College, and Dulwich College arranged for us to have a bit of education as well in the afternoons. And we had English and French and maybe for a term or so, but not much more. Otherwise, we're completely dedicated to learning Japanese, except, of course, for the long summer vacations. When we went harvesting and did various things of that kind.
Did you learn about Japanese history and culture as well as language, or just about
It was just language at that point, except insofar as the Japanese teachers would take off from some of the things that they were telling us about to give us informal instruction. I mean, I think you said at lunch that the language is the culture,
yes.
And in learning the language you cannot but, especially if you've got a good teacher, you cannot but be learning something about the culture. But apart from that, no, there was no deliberate organized attempt to tell us about Japan.
Was it supposed to be a very, very difficult language to learn? Did you find it very, very difficult or not?
Yes, I don't really remember. I mean, I do remember that learning the characters, learning to write it, was fun. It was a kind of, you know, everyone was a puzzle. Acquiring fluency and manipulating the grammatical structure was not so much fun. For anyone who's got linguistic curiosity, almost any language is learning can be fun, I think.
Did it lead to a degree or just a...
No, it didn't, but I mean, my second stroke of luck was that when we'd finished and were put in the army and did our primary training, I tripped over my rifle at one stage and got a swollen knee and had to go in hospital. So I got behind all the others, they went off to India, and I was waiting. This was in 44, yes, at the end of 44, beginning 45. The end of 44, the autumn of 44. They went off to India, and I was finished my training and was ready, waiting for the next boat. And they decided that they needed to expand the courses at SOAS, but didn't have enough teachers, and I was still in the country, so I was brought back to SOAS to teach until I was demobilized in 1947, because the courses continued through 47, 48. And then, of course, I had a splendid opportunity. And I took an external degree in Japanese before I was demobilized.
At London University.
At London, You know, you didn't actually have to be registered as an internal student. I was more internal. I mean, the people who were marking my papers were at the same time colleagues on the staff. And I was also had the advantage of being the first ever to take a new degree in modern Japanese studies, which had just been devised. There was a newspaper correspondent who had been stranded, or rather, he'd married an English woman before the war, and became a teacher. And there was Frank Daniels was the central professor. He had been teaching English in Japan during the war, and his wife was also, she was a Japanese. That was about all. Otto van der Sprenkel? Yeah, I mean, you know Sybil, doubtless. Sybil van der Sprenkel? Who wrote a very good thesis on law in Qing China. Otto wrote on population in China and that thing. He had a smattering of Japanese history, and he marked my tentative essays and so on. So I had a relatively easy passage. And that's the only degree I've ever had, actually.
You're part of that great generation who never went on to
PhDs. Right, yes. I mean, it was not required. Yes.
Then there's just a couple of years before you go to Japan. What were you doing in those 2 years after you went to Japan?
Waiting to go to Japan, because I got a travelling scholarship on the basis of the final exam, and applied for a visa, and of course was refused. But meanwhile, I had decided what I was going to write a PhD on. Having in the summer of my demobilization leave in 1947, I went to Cambridge to catalogue the library of Sir Ernest Mason Satow and W.G. Aston, two pioneers of Japanese studies who had left their books to Cambridge. And that was a very pleasant experience. And it gave me sort of time to think. And I did come across a book which Aston had written about, the autobiography of a Confucian scholar, Arai Hakuseki, in which he had an interesting description of how he learned about the Chinese classics in his childhood. And that made me think, I haven't read anything else about schools and education in talking about Japan, so here's a good subject.
That led into your well-known book on Tokugawa education.
Well, I don't know how well-known it is. It didn't sell very many copies, but... But yeah, yes, that led to that.
So you were sort of preparing all the time to go to Japan. When you finally got to Japan. That was 51, was it?
Beginning of 50. 50. Yes, yes, January.
Can you cast your mind back to your first impression as you sailed into
Yes. I mean, I did keep a diary then. I looked at it the other day, so I mean, I don't. Until I looked at the diary, it was more or less a blank. Clearly, I was tremendously impressed. First of all, by the physical sight, coming into Kobe Harbour. Which, you know, with the mountains behind and so on. And then going ashore. It happened to be the 21st of March, which in the old Buddhist calendar is Higan, where the spirits cross to the other shore. Is that what Higan meant? Anyway, it's an old Buddhist festival. Became, of course, in modern Japan, the festival celebration of the imperial ancestors. And then in democratic Japan became the spring festival. And anyway, it was a public holiday. And there were a number of, along a number of the streets, most of the houses had flags, Japanese rising sun flags. And I gathered, I was hearing my first radio broadcast, that there was an organization called the Society for the Promotion of Waving Flags, of putting out flags on national festivals, which struck me, and I think it was indeed a symptom of the fact that the Japanese were finally recovering a bit of national self-confidence. But at the same time, of course, to everybody on the left in Japan, the rising sun, the national flag, was a symbol of the militarism that they had after 1945, and many of them earlier, learned to reject and abhor. So that whether or not one should put up a flag in primary schools, and whether or not children should be asked to salute it when it was raised in the morning, became one of the central political issues of Japanese education until died down, I suppose, in the last 10 years. But until very, very recently, and in some schools, still, you know, it's an intensely controversial issue.
So, Ron, we just got you to Japan in 1950.
Mm-hmm.
You were talking about your impressions. What had you gone to do in Japan? I mean, why were you there?
To work on the thesis that I'd started in London on Tokugawa education, but also to turn myself into somebody who could, on return, become a lecturer in Japanese institutions. There was an expansion of jobs at the School of Oriental Studies after the war in Japanese studies. Three or four posts in Japanese language and literature, one of which I thought I would probably get. It turned out that they all went to other people while I was still waiting to go to Japan. And the only one left was one in Japanese institutions. And it was, the man who designed it thought of quaint festivals and customs of the Japanese sort of thing. Mm. Anyway, I...
Who was it who designed it?
Frank Daniels, whom I mentioned just now, the teacher. Who ended up spending many years of his retired life collecting folk tales about snakes in Japan, as I recall. So before I went to Japan, before the chance of going occurred at the end of 1949, I spent the first term of that year at the LSE, or at least I took a course from Tom Marshall in social institutions, and a course in social psychology from Norman Hotov. So I was, I had some notion of what sociology was. And when I got to Japan, I registered in the sociology department as an occasional graduate student of some kind. They promised that in the end, if I wrote a thesis, they would give me some kind of certificate. It was all very, very vague and informal. But I spent 18 months there, mostly hobnobbing with the sociologists and going on research trips to villages and so on, and conceived the idea halfway through of trying to do a kind of social survey in the little precinct ward that I was living in, a ward of about 300 households. And I recall, the first inkling of the idea of doing something of this kind was on the boat going to Japan. I was eventually smuggled in as the honorary secretary of the cultural advisor to the United Kingdom liaison mission to the Supreme Command of the Allied Powers, which was the British Embassy. I mean, it was the job that eventually became the head of the British Council. And I lived with them for the first 6 months until a student visa was available. A splendid, fascinating character called George Fraser, Scottish poet. And we were talking, he was also something of a polymath. And he said, he said something like, what are you going to do in Japan? I mean, after all, you can't do a middle town all by yourself, can you? And I...
He knew about the Linz and
the Linz, exactly. And I thought then, well, I don't quite see why not. I mean, on a kind of smaller scale. And so that was the first thing that set the idea in my mind. And then I remember when I decided that I would do it, I went along to see a couple of sociologists whom I'd acquainted with, a couple of Americans who were working in the civil education office of the American occupation headquarters. One was Herb Passen, who was great fun. The other was John Bennett. John Bennett, who was a straight up and down sociologist from the Midwest. And I sort of tentatively, I can't remember how I presented the idea. He said, "What's your hypothesis?" You can't do research without a hypothesis. And I thought, well, maybe just sort of exploring and finding out how things were had some point in itself.
You didn't, before I forget, you didn't ever meet Masao Maruyama.
Yes. Oh, yes. Yes. No, we were very good friends.
Really?
Yes.
Can you say something about him? Because he's such a major figure in the 20th century.
Absolutely. Yes. Mm. Yes. And I mean, immensely vivacious. Mm. His eyes would sparkle, and he was totally engaged in conversation about anything. Passion for classical opera. He and Nancy sat down one afternoon and when there must have been DVDs, I guess. I mean, the very first kind of CDs with pictures. Video discs. Yes. That must have been 15 years ago or so. Yes, when he was. And he also, well, upon his music, he also had built himself an amplifier with, you know, these enormous bulbs that, that would, in the 1930s, have been spent there. Anyway, I first met him because a friend at Cambridge, John McEwan, who wrote a very good book on Ogyu Sorai before he got schizophrenia and sort of came to a very sad end. John McEwan has written this book on Ogyu Sorai, and of course Mariam had also done some work on Ogyu Sorai. So I went along to see him to talk about Ogyu Sorai. I'm not quite sure whether I was asking him for some kind of on behalf of McEwan or whatever. But that was the first time I met him. He was an enormously attractive person. And then we became friends on my second visit to Japan, when I was doing work on land reform. And he ran some seminars for me at which I sort of tried out my ideas on the relation between the rise of fascism and the agrarian situation in Japan and so on. Extremely helpful in that. And then, of course, he came to Oxford for a while, and we saw something.
I talked to him, Carmen Blacker, about him. She knew him a bit.
Yes.
He seems a very philosophical writer, too. I mean, did he know a lot about Western philosophy as well as Western classical?
Oh, enormously, yeah. I mean, he was particularly well-read in the German political science literature. But then that was in 1950. I mean, he was particular, but by then he had begun catching up with the current American literature, but also with European, with Mill and Locke and you know the whole British tradition too. He was a genuine polymath. And the Mariama industry since his death is enormous. I mean, there's still a magazine being published of occasional pieces that Mariama had written in. The notes that people had taken of Mariama's extemporary talks at student seminars and so on.
Like Adam Smith.
Yes, except that Mariama lived in a rather more literate society than Adam Smith, and there are far more people, you know, where pens and pencils were cheaper, and far more people taking notes. But his vitality was amazing, because he had a bad tuberculosis immediately after the war, and he was one of the first people to have the operation which entirely deflates one lung. I'm sorry. he lived the rest of his life on one lung.
During the war, he must have been under house arrest or anything?
No, he was in the army. Oh yes. And in fact, he was in Hiroshima at the time the bomb dropped.
Really?
At some distance from the epicenter. But he's written. I read some reminiscences of his about the time of his call up and so on quite recently, but I don't remember them very, very, very clearly. But he was obviously at that time destined to become the successor of Nambara as the professor of political science at Tokyo. Great charm.
Were there any other Japanese scholars whom you particularly admire, or you particularly remember? I mean, there must be quite a lot, but Is it possible to single out one or two?
Well, at that time, I suppose the sociology of law, Professor Kawashima Takeyoshi, was a very influential, and a very good friend, not a social scientist, but a polymath. Kato Shuichi, who has who's still writing vast quantities, was once a novelist. I mean, he's written a couple of novels. A poet. He ran a poetry magazine immediately after the war. That was his, and then went to France in order to do hematological research. And didn't do a great deal of hematological research, but he did learn a great deal about the Intellectual Society of Paris. He's still going very strong. I remember in 1960, I was recalling this the other day, we were at an American-inspired conference on modernization. And this was just after the great riots in Tokyo over the extension of the security treaty, the American security treaty, when for the best part of 2 months, I mean, students were demonstrating almost daily outside the parliament buildings, and the passage of the bill was much delayed by continuous demonstrations. And Eisenhower's intended visit had been cancelled and so on. It was the central political event of the post-war Japan. I mean, apart from the surrender and the constitution and the post-occupation Japan. Kawashima was there, and Maruyama, and Kato, and I remember the four of us arguing about these events. And I arguing that, on the whole, the security treaty was a good thing, because it prevented Japan from rearming. And after all, I mean, what they really feared was a repetition of the 1930s in Japan. Kato was mostly silent. Kawashima was absolutely furious. And Maruyama was kind of cool, amused, and amused at the kind of ferocity of the feelings, had a kind of long-term perspective on the whole thing, you know, foresaw that the day would come. In fact, in these demonstrations in 1960s. Maruyama was the great intellectual leader of the left-wing opposition. People of his generation still, or subsequent generation, I mean, fairly subsequent generation, still remember his one of his speeches about returning to one's beginnings, which is a good Confucian phrase. I forget whether it comes from the Analects or where it comes from, but it had great resonance among the students at this time.
We recently went to China to what was Manchuria, and were of course told the stories of the Japanese occupation, and having been enormously admiring of what we've seen of modern Japan and what I've read of Japanese 19th and previous century history, we're particularly puzzled at the double side, I mean, the chrysanthemum and the sword kind of position. How you can get a country which is so artistically and philosophically and in many ways peaceful and then behave in the way that the Japanese behaved in Korea and China. Do you have any sort of thoughts on how you can get this? I mean, most countries are like this, but it seems more extreme in the Japanese case.
Well, it was a barbarous war to start with. I mean, it was barbarous on both sides. Chinese were killing each other, you know, with very much the same sort of indiscriminate abandon as the Japanese were killing the Chinese. I think there are two things. Two things happening. First, individual cruelty of individual Japanese, and that there was a lot of, undoubtedly, but not as much, I think, as the Chinese version of the occupation suggests. I think there was a lot much more, there was a good deal more fraternizing, a good deal more decent human behavior on the part of Japanese soldiers than it ever appears in the Chinese narratives. And recently there was published the diaries of the German representative of Siemens in Nanking, which has a reasonably plausible account of what happened in Nanking. And it does seem that although, I mean, it was quite clear that the Japanese troops were given license to kill anybody whom they thought might be a Chinese soldier who had abandoned his uniform and taken to civilian clothes. And there was certainly a certain amount of rape and pillage going on. But the Japanese officers whom this man talked to did seem to be intent on keeping a lid on this kind of thing. It was, I mean, I think we do get a picture of that war, primarily from the Tokyo War Crimes Trials and from the Chinese version, which exaggerates the awfulness of Japanese behavior, which is not to say that Japanese behavior there was by any means exemplary. And it's certainly true that it compared, as everybody said, very badly with the treatment of Russian prisoners in the Russo-Japanese War. And that's pure racism. I mean, it was at the time of the Russo-Japanese War, the Japanese were seeking to join the great powers, and the codes of behavior of the great powers were something that they respected. But in the Great East Asian War, as they came to call it, they were trying to destroy and overwhelm the Western world that had rejected them. So there were no holds barred in terms of policy, in terms of bombing, and I mean the way you conduct the war. These were members of an inferior race. But the contrast between the colonial regime in Taiwan and the colonial regime in Korea is quite striking. When the Taiwanese more or less accepted Japanese dominance, and of course there was a great deal of economic development and educational development in Taiwan, as there was also in Korea. I mean, the growth of literacy under Japanese occupation in Korea was extremely rapid, and the growth of agricultural cooperative organization and so on. But there was a resistance movement in Korea. I mean, there was a very real Korean nationalism that they had to contend with, and they often did so very brutally.
Coming back to
but how much more brutally than we did in India? Not so very different, I would say.
Coming back to Japan, many Japanese say that it's almost impossible for any outside analyst really to understand Japan. And equally impossible for the Japanese to understand Japan as well. If you had to, I mean, firstly, do you think that's true? And secondly, if one was attempting to understand it, what do you think are the sort of keys to approaching an understanding of Japanese civilization?
Well, I mean, I don't think that I understand British civilization in any... I mean, I don't know what people mean when they say it's impossible to understand Japanese. I find it not much more difficult to intuit what people are really thinking from what they say in Japan than in Britain. But that is because I've spent so much time, you know, having learned the language well at the beginning, spent so much time talking to so many different Japanese that one gets an instinctive feel for that. Now, whether being able to intuit what people are quote meaning from what they say is understanding a civilization, I don't know. Mm. But it seems to me one important element.
Yes, and the methodologists believe that if you can predict how they will behave and see the logic of their behavior, then you're halfway there. But
now Japan is such a... I mean, even when I first went there, Japan was such a diverse society that one could certainly not predict the behavior of any Japanese from any standard stereotype of a Japanese. The difference in thinking and feeling between a country peasant and a professor of a university, I mean, a third generation modernizee like Maruyama, for example, striking.
Coming back to the question of the keys or the ways to help someone who is starting on the study of Japanese civilization, are there certain things you think they should look at, or I mean the art or the garden architecture or sense of humour, or where would one start, you think?
It's such a hole that the only thing is to soak yourself in everything. I mean, there are a lot of people in Wisley who are who know an enormous amount about gardens in this country, but that's not typical of the English character. Similarly, there are a lot of people. I mean, the taste for going to see fine gardens is much more widely diffused in Japan than it is in Britain, than it is in Italy, say. Because in Britain, I mean, the country house has visitors in very large numbers. It's more widely diffused, I suppose, but I wouldn't have said it's a more integrally a part of the Japanese character or of Japanese civilization. If one is talking about ways of patterns of social relations, ways of thinking and feeling, the distance between the characters who appear in a novel by Natsume Soseki written in 1910 and the characters who appear in a novel written by Banana Yoshimoto is enormous.
When did Yoshimoto write?
80s, 90s, or Murakami Haruki Murakami, who is now all over the bookshops in London too. I mean, an enormous difference, and I would have said a much greater difference between not sure, Arnold Bennett and Will Self or Martin Amis. Yeah, I mean, there's a big difference there too, But I think the change in dominant literary tastes and the patterns of social relations reflected in fiction has been much greater in Japan than it has in this country.
Because our Japanese friends say that there was, between 1950 and 1980, an absolute revolution in Japan, in its, not just its material standards, but its social structure, and almost everything in Japan changed hugely. They felt they were living through a vast revolution.
Mm.
Did you feel the same thing? Because this was the main time you were working. That Japan was transformed entirely from 1950 to 1980, the end of the bubble.
Well, the there's enormous transformation in patterns of in material comforts and so on, standard of living. But no, I wouldn't have said that there was an enormous. In fact, I think the whole period from 1955 to 1990, say, was one of gradual entrenchment of a pattern of institutions which was gradually forming up in the 50s. And both there was stasis in politics, for example. There was very little change in the educational system, except that most of the bright people had been drawn out of the villages. So the rate of social mobility was declining. I mean, there'd been an enormous movement of bright children into top universities from the villages in the 50s and 60s. One of the crucial things, the pattern of corporate organization and employment in the large corporations was becoming more and more institutionalized and more routinized and more rigid. The attempt has been made particularly since the middle of the 90s, to break the mold in a way that Reagan and Thatcher broke the mold of a relatively, well-established, socially responsible capitalism, which we had in the 1960s, freed up free market individualism. That same set of changes, which if they were carried through would be quite revolutionary, really only began in the 1990s and hasn't got very far.
This actually links to a theme in one of your most recent books about whether Japan and Western capitalism are converging or going to run in parallel for a long time but never to converge.
Mm.
What's your current thinking on that?
That convergence is very much on the cards. It does now become slightly more problematic. I mean, if the American economy goes down for a prolonged period, I mean, if there anything even approaching the 1930s is repeated, then a lot of the people who are trying to change the economic structure of Japan, the structure of capitalism, on American lines, will have one of their major arguments removed. I mean, already two things gave an enormous spurt to the Americanizers. I mean, it's not a matter of convergence as a result. There is some convergence as a result of the inner evolution of the fact that fewer and fewer of economic transactions are, a smaller and smaller proportion of economic transactions are conducted face-to-face or even over the telephone and are much more arm's length. I mean, that has an inevitable effect in diminishing the role of trust and increasing the role of legal institutions, legal enforcement of contract in the society. So there is that element of internal evolution, the working through of the system, which leads to convergence. But the dominant force of convergence is imitation of the admired pattern of America. And of course, the admiration which inspired the reformers, which was their constant theme in the late 1990s, was first of all the dynamism of Silicon Valley. I mean, the capacity to innovate of the American economy, which they thought the Japanese lacked. And secondly, the enormous profits, of course, of American corporations, and the fact that they were squeezing far more out of it wasn't so much that productivity growth rate was higher, but profit rates were of course very much higher in Japan. They were much, much lower in Japan because much more of the value added went into wages, and that the onus of capital had until 1990 been adequately compensated for by capital gains because of the steady asset inflation that was going on. And all that was the reason, I mean, the fact that the Americans' corporations were so much more efficient in terms of profit, and Silicon Valley, and also American corporations were supposed to be much more transparent. I mean, the corporate governance, boardrooms run by external directors, you know, who kept an eye on managers and stopped them from cheating. Now, the collapse of Silicon Valley and of NASDAQ, and the whole technology bubble, and then Enron and WorldCom showing that the most supposedly transparent accounting systems can, when you have a system of stock options which reward managers for share manipulation, can nevertheless lead to dishonesty on an enormous scale. People are beginning to have doubts about the corporate governance reforms that the reformers have been advocating. Whether or not there's going to be more convergence over the next 10 years or not, it seems to me extremely unpredictable.
Might there be more convergence with China? Because they've always felt ambivalent towards China, a fear and certain respect. And China, of course, is growing very fast and in a mixed model.
Yes. Yeah. A mixed model in which, at the moment, the American style of corporation is dominating. Mm. Nevertheless, there is there's still the kind of ground base of Chinese ethical culture, which is very similar to that of Japanese. I mean, the sense of duty and obligation and so on. And there is also still a very strongly institutionalized practice of lifetime employment in the ex-state-owned organizations. And, of course, there's still a very heavy public element in the ownership of industry, in spite of their attempts to grow a stock market that will be as much a reflection of a mirror of the true value of companies as it is in the United States, supposedly. But I think whether or not China and Japan will emerge with similar institutions depends very much on the development of the strategic relationship between China and the United States. I mean, if it, there is a very good reason for, I mean, it's there is a very plausible scenario which one could elaborate, which has China and the United States in the same sort of Cold War competition as China and Russia were for the whole of the period until 1990, as Japan, US and Russia were until 1990. I mean, China has enormous intellectual resources. It is expanding its science and technology university departments at a great rate. The sense of resentment at the fact that American spy planes can with impunity patrol outside China's territorial waters, but the idea of a Chinese spy plane getting near the coasts of Oregon would be, I mean, totally unthinkable. And that inequality, that imbalance, produces a sort of feeling that was produced in Japan by the Washington and London naval treaties, you know, which confined Japan to having only 3 battleships for every 5 that Britain and the United States should have, and so on, keeping them in their place. And when the United States, what was the strategy document which was published in last autumn? I forget, the strategic outlines or something. And it says quite explicitly that the aim of American policy will be to prevent any other power from even coming near rivaling America's supremacy. It seems likely that as China gets, I mean, it presumably will be a kind of electronic warfare competition in building missiles that can penetrate missile defenses and missile defenses that are impervious to enemies and so on and so forth. And there is presumably endless possibilities of the escalation of such a competition. And I think China does have the possibility of developing the intellectual and physical scientific resources of making people in the Pentagon think that they're a serious rival. As you know, the Soviet missile scare was used by the armors in the 70s and 80s and so on. So I think there's a good potential for a situation of tension between the U.S. and China, which will put Japan in a very difficult position. I think there are among the people, I mean the top, if you put it in terms of earners, I mean, well, top civil servants, top businessmen, and so on, of the generation now in their 40s and 50s and so on, I think a very large majority would have, a majority would have no hesitation in throwing in their lot with the United States and continuing the present security arrangement. But I think there is, even among them, they would be repressing a certain sense of resentment at the fact that they are very much younger brother to the United States. You know, they really don't count in world affairs and any decision making. And among what I think now is a minority, there are a lot of people who feel they don't feel much kinship with China anymore, in the way that people who would now be 80 or so, and who learned in their high school, read Chinese classics. and heard people talking about members of the same race, same culture. And there's a splendid phrase, "Do bun do shu." We write with the same script, and we are genetically of the same racial people. People who during the war were fed that kind of that kind of notion do have a sense of kinship with the Chinese. And of course, I mean, there is the physical fact that when a Japanese walks down the street in Paris, I mean, he stands out as being different. When he walks around in Beijing, he doesn't stand out. And there are an increasing number of the younger generation who are going to China and learning Chinese quite fluently, but far, far smaller than the hordes that flock to American lesser universities. So how that will play out again is exceedingly unpredictable.
You've written many books, many of them very influential. You had to pick out one of them on your so-called desert island, which you would take as what you think is your most important contribution to either sociology or Japanese studies. Which one do you think you would choose and why?
Perhaps the most, the most original, I think, is probably Diploma Disease. But that was much less of a scholarly production than a polemic, although it was based on a good deal of research, not only in Japan, a bit of reading about Britain, Sri Lanka, and research in Sri Lanka, and a bit of reading about Kenya and so on. But that wasn't...
The theme, I mean, it's rather... I'm just yesterday was reading John Haynell's whatever trap, you know, education trap.
Aha.
It's rather curious that two distinguished LSE professors should write about the traps in education. This was high school and university career,
yeah.
Of course. The theme of the Diploma Disease, which unfortunately I haven't read, but I imagine it's the tendency of all educational systems to elongate and become more and more concerned with producing longer and longer times when you have become educated and get more and more qualified.
No. It was much more about the... about the way, I mean, you were talking earlier about your granddaughter of five already being under pressure for passing examinations, so on.
Yes.
No, it was about the bureaucratization of society and the way in which getting certificates becomes a necessity for building careers. And the way in which the mechanisms of social selection become entirely focused on education institutions, which has the effect in developing countries. I mean, it's mostly about developing countries. It was using Japan. The thesis was that the later countries enter the world of building modern education systems and the process of bureaucratization, the more the development of the educational system runs ahead of the creation of jobs for the educated in the economy. I mean, it started by going to Sri Lanka as a member of an employment mission at the time of the youth insurrection, when the main problem was that they had university graduates, I mean, that only a half of every annual crop of university graduates could ever get a job. And they were increasingly taking the jobs of the A-level students, and the A-level students, you know, were taking over the jobs that the O-level students. It was about the process of escalation of qualification and so forth. And that That I think was probably the most original, but the more scholarly work based on more detailed fieldwork was the factory book, I think. British factory, Japanese factory, yeah. And that got more attention because there had been the general assumption of convergence on the Western model, the modernization assumption and so on. And the fact that one could argue the contrary and have a whole chapter entitled Britain Catching Up? And find plausible reasons for suggesting that Britain was moving towards more and more towards lifetime employment and educational selection at the point of entry, and also more and more towards enterprise unions. I mean, the enterprise unions bit hasn't happened as far as the overall structure is concerned, but it's still nevertheless, I mean, the total breakdown of national negotiations in Britain in favour of workplace and company negotiations has proved that right. It's clearly a much more complex process of convergence and divergence than I suggested in that book. But at least that was the thesis that got the book talked about. The descriptive ethnography of it, I think, was still reasonably interesting in that sense. But it's still not as readable. The most readable book, I think, I produced is the one on the village called Shinohata, where I was trying to make it readable. And while at the same time, it was slightly difficult because one didn't want to be making these peasants out to be, funny people, conforming to British and American readers' notions of, the impossibly naive and simple Japanese. There were, and particularly in reporting things, the family that I live with, whom I had a great respect and fondness. One problem, of course, was telling stories that they had told me about other villagers, which, had it got back to the other villagers, they would know who had told these stories to their detriment. That was one problem. But the other was this problem of not making them out to be comic yokels. But there was a lot of good material to make it a readable book.
Mm. Turning to the other question I want to ask you about, you've gone alongside many distinguished academics, both in Sussex and in the LSE and in other places where you've taught. One of them I particularly want to ask you about, because I've interviewed, or at least known him very well, is Ernest Gellner.
Mm. Mm.
And you were born in the same year and had sort of a parallel career in some ways, branching across disciplines. Is there anything you'd like to say about Ernest, either as a person or as an academic?
Oh, he was just a splendid person. I first, in that term, when I decided to turn myself into a sociologist in 1949, Ernest was giving a course. He'd just joined the LSE and was giving a course of lectures on political philosophy. that I went to. I found them extremely knotty, difficult. But he was then a very insecure, very diffident person, but one immediately felt, you know, what warmth there was. I then didn't see him again until we became colleagues in 1960 at the LSE. And we were joined not only, you know, by some kind of mutual sympathy, but also by joint dislike of people like yes, especially Donald McCrae. Yes. Yes. Poor Donald met a sad end. Yes. And Ernest, well, I mean, we had a great deal in common, and I enjoyed reading his books. I thought very frequently that, you know, he cut a lot of corners in his logic, and I mean once or twice I'd sat down with an Ernest book and written him a kind of commentary, you know, argument, but never managed to engage him. Never managed to get a reply. This was later, I guess, when we were not colleagues and so on. We were not seeing each other regularly, but we became very good friends and our families. You know, we went to stay for the weekend. Sorry,
in Italy?
No, I never got to his house in Italy. The only time I was with him in Italy was skiing Sestriere once when we were going back from a conference. And we once went to the lake north of Rome when I had to write my inaugural and Ernest had to write something or other. So we found a little hotel and stayed 5 or 6 days there. I think it was March. Anyhow, the lake was very cold. But Ernest insisted that he was going to be bathing in he'd already bathed in, you know, six different oceans, whatever, and that this low temperature was not going to deter him. So he went out every day and swam in this cold lake, which I funked. After the first attempt, and
would you say he was? How highly would you rate him? Some people say he was one of the last great polymaths or Enlightenment thinkers.
I think Enlightenment thinker is a good description. Yeah. I mean, I would rate him very highly. Whether he would count. I was thinking about Isaiah Berlin, for example, whom Ernest once referred to as the best. Capable of turning everything into in any academic subject into an after-dinner speech, something on those lines. He had no great love for Berlin. He obviously didn't make his mark in the way that Berlin did, but the range that he had, particularly from his not only being soaked in Western philosophy, but also having his Arab and Berber, you know, feel for a totally different culture. This gave him a range of reference in argument, And I think, you know, his take on something like on nationalism, for example, was that book on nationalism. Everything he wrote hastily. I mean, he would always apologize for the fact that he was a compulsive writer and couldn't stop. Everything he wrote was, you know, had every 10 pages or so there was something that that struck him. My God, I wish I'd thought of that kind of thing. And as I say, on nationalism, for example, I thought he had, I mean, of all the books that have been written on nationalism, this is one of the best, I think.
Is there anyone else? I mean, I'd like to go on. I have another chance to talk, but is there any other person, either at the LSE or elsewhere, who has particularly engaged you or influenced you?
In the early days at the LSE, David Glass. And his work on, I mean, he was a terribly cynical sort of person, I mean, totally different from Ernest, but his very careful empiricism influenced me a good deal in the very beginning. And he got me interested in population studies at an early stage, which is good. Who else? I've had very, very few close friends and mentors, I guess, outside of the field of Japanese studies. I mean, and most of the... most of the people in Japanese studies were contemporaries and colleagues rather than mentors and sources of influence. There are a lot of people I admire, but I can't rank them as influences on my own work.
Among the great dead white males or sociologists of the past, would Weber be the person you...
Yes, absolutely. Weber's, I mean, certainly Weber above Durkheim.
And Marx,
yes, absolutely. And more recently, I mean, David Riesman, for example, I had enormous respect for, and his Lonely Crowd was a great influence on my thinking about the development of Japanese society in that first book that I wrote on city life in Japan, which I think I've fully acknowledged that. Homans also, I mean, of contemporary sociologists, Homans always struck me as being a very, very insightful, interesting character, who, like yourself, of course, started.
Is there anything else I should have asked or you'd like to say?
Apropos of good sociologists, Gary Runciman, I think, I have a great respect for. I don't fully share his fascination with evolution these days, but I think, I mean, his book on theory and his occasional essays are first rate. No, I can't think of anything else you should have asked me.
You will, probably after this. But thank you very much indeed.
Not at all.